Welcome to the 12th edition of the St. Petersburg, Florida Area News Podcast for the year 2019. I'm your host, Joshua Black. In today's episode, we'll cover the full day meeting of the St. Petersburg City Council for April 4th. Councilman Ed Montaneri from District 3 was not in attendance due to illness. Please pray for his recovery. Councilmember Lisa Wheeler Bowman, District 7, was back in attendance after dealing with the death in her family early last month. It was revealed that she had left the council committee meetings on March 28th to attend the board meeting on the St. Petersburg Housing Authority. She gave a report at the end of the council meeting. It wasn't good. But before we go there, the city council began with its usual hoopla, including the approval of the agenda and of the consent agenda. I rose to object to the consent agenda because of the millions of dollars reflected in the contracts without discussion or debate. Because I used the word irresponsible in my remarks, Charlie Gerdes, council chair representative from District 1, chose to respond to my complaint by stating that most of the consent agenda items that day represented renewals of contracts, not brand new projects. He also stated that they were already anticipated in the budget since they're usually multi-year projects. Steve Cornell, District 5, pointed to the $800,000 item for water meters and said that there really isn't room to debate on items like that. In my mind, there is, but we'd have to change the way we do government. During the open forum, many of members of the community spoke against the government's lack of openness and communication with regard to the execution of both the Complete Streets Project and the Bus Rapid Transit Program. Their words largely fell on deaf ears, but they could indicate a lawsuit in the works. For my time during the open forum, I stated that, seeing that none of the council members present were elected unanimously, they should refrain from pushing their own ideas on other people, especially since God says that governments are established to get justice for victims, not to control the way we live our lives. Of course, that went unheeded, too. Council moved on to public hearings for new ordinances. The proposal to name the Sanitation Department Administration Building after the late Benjamin F. Shirley passed unanimously. So did the granting of the public utility easement to Duke Energy within Booker Creek Park. I didn't rise to object to the existence of a government-protected monopoly at this point, but I wanted to. Next, the new tenants of the Manhattan Casino gave their yearly update to their landlord. The reviews for the report were mixed, with the administration giving praise, but with council members concerned that promises made by the tenants in order to get the lease weren't being realized. These promises were made without regard to the time and money it would take to invest in them, and without regard to the level of productivity required by the participants to make them sustainable. So, typical political promises. The result is that the Callaloo Group hasn't hired the number of folks from the community they had hoped or realized the volume of business they had expected. It's almost as if mixing political goals with business goals isn't a good idea for a startup. This isn't the first failure realized by the city council in terms of writing business contracts with politically oriented social impacts as goals. Amy Foster mentioned at least three projects in her remarks. Keep this in mind when we discuss the grant program in 2 weeks for the Storefront Conservation Corridor overlay. After a short break, council took up an item Ed Montaneri had pulled from the consent agenda regarding asset forfeiture. The city police officer brought up an attorney with the police department to explain how they handle forfeitures legally. This forfeiture was from the U.S. Treasury Department. Others have come from the Department of Justice or its agencies. Still others could be initiated by the police department itself. The one that I found too late a few months ago was from the Department of Justice. I rose to object to this theft practice by pointing out that the owner isn't always charged with a crime when the seizure of the property is initiated, and that it isn't required that he be convicted before the property can be forfeited to the department. The attorney for the police department answered skillfully and deceitfully by addressing only the statutes that cover department-initiated seizures, not U.S. Treasury or Department of Justice seizures. Police department seizures are indeed covered under the recently changed Florida statute that requires an arrest before or with the seizure and requires the department to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the property in question, not the owner, but the property itself, has been involved in criminal conduct. Thus, the department attorney insisted that due process does exist for these cases, but who can afford both an attorney to address the criminal complaint and an attorney to address the civil complaint, which is what forfeiture proceedings fall under. And what about cases in which the criminal is not the owner of the property? In addition, neither Treasury seizures nor Department of Justice seizures are conducted under these rules. This was a Treasury seizure, and no information was given about how many cases this money represented or the owners of the property were ever charged with crime. Nor was there any effort by the police department to reveal what harm they had suffered by investigating the crime in order to be rightly deemed as victims worthy of restitution of some sort from these funds. I had already stepped back and sat down, so I didn't reply with that. Maybe I would have been allowed to. I didn't know, so I didn't try. Thus, the council members in attendance voted unanimously to allow the transfer. Then council adjourned temporarily in order to convene as Community Redevelopment Agency. The discussion was, once again, the new project by the Bizu Group known as the Blue Lotus. This project has been stopped 2 or 3 times already, and the developer keeps making changes that they think will address the objections of the residents nearby and thus win approval. This time, they got the approval after about 40 people mostly used their 3 minutes to speak against it. The fiercest opposition comes from residents of the next-door Flory de Leon complex. They don't want to be in the shadow of a skyscraper and have argued this project down to 19 stories from about 25. The developer has also incorporated design themes from the Flory on the lower levels in this latest plan. The vote was 5-2 with Cornell and Rice opposed. Then council adjourned to CRA and reconvened this council. There was a lot to learn in the sewer report given by Claude Tankersley. First, the Southwest Water Treatment Plant originally had a renovation budget of about $31 million. Total cost to date is $60 million, and Claude insists that he was making the last request for funding. 3 projects in his request, totaling more than $5.3 million. The funding for these contracts comes from a $100 million contingency fund that was set aside in anticipation of these cost overruns. The result is that the capacity of the treatment facility has been improved to 70 million gallons per day at peak. The administration expects this to be enough to handle future storms so as not to be forced to dump raw sewage into the bay if we get hit by another hurricane or extended rainstorms. I don't know when we'll find out if they're right. Jacobs Group got another extension to their already $4 million contract. The city agreed to pay them another $271,100 to study rain-derived inflow and infiltration. Leaks into the water distribution pipes that the city believes are exacerbating the Water Resources Department's capacity deficiencies. Claude later stated that downtown city residents normally use 28 million gallons per day, while the treatment capacity for the downtown treatment plant is 60 million. The distribution capacity for that development zone is 80 million. The plan for Jacobs is to help the city identify the leaks so the city can line the affected pipes with a new tube that won't leak and won't allow intrusion. Claude also asked for and received approval for the annual rate study so the city can decide whether they're charging people enough on their water bills. Combine this with the new plan for the city to charge residents for suspected impact of impervious land on their property, looking for council approval in September or October, and you can expect a rude awakening on your water bill next year. There were 2 different contracts for the Stantec Group to cover both of these rate studies, the annual for $159,640 and the new for $216,975. Claude also noted that there were 6 unauthorized discharges by pipes holding reclaimed water. He stated that these were caused by connection saddles failing due to temperature and/or pressure changes. He also reported 3 wastewater discharges. He stated that 2 were caused by grease in the pipes and 1 was by a rag. For previous discharges, he reported that the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is fining the city $60,000. Some of the discharges previously reported were not counted against them because they were contained quickly and not allowed to contaminate the ground or nearby bodies of water. City Council also heard a request for rehearing in the matter of the Driftwood Historic Neighborhood designation. You may recall that opponents alleged that some ballots had not been properly date stamped and thus should not have been counted, At that time, Derek Kilborn stated that the city had indeed received the ballots in the time required and that the lack of a physical date stamp didn't void that. He pointed to the fact that the ballots in question were included in a tally sent out by email before the deadline and stated that it would be proven by the computer timestamps on the log sheet and on the email. The city's attorney stated that during the hearing would allow the evidence defending Kilborn's statement to be recorded as evidence that the city was acting in good faith and would boost the city's case in court. Rice was frustrated, but the council unanimously agreed to schedule the rehearing for May 16th. Gabbard announced that she would be absent, but no one moved to change the date to accommodate her. I'm not sure if she just didn't want the rehearing or not, but she could have made the motion to reschedule it herself. Wheeler Bowman then gave her report on the St. Petersburg Housing Authority at this point. The board actually had a member make a vote in committee before that member had been approved to serve on that committee. Further, the administration of the Housing Authority had culled its 14,000 name wait list for Section 8 housing to 2,200 by sending both emails and USPS mail to applicants and removing them if they received no response. Council members expressed concern that the authority was being neglectful, stating that they could not see how nearly 12,000 people who requested housing vouchers in 2015 would no longer need them today. I can. Maybe 12,000 people saw that they couldn't rely on the government and found a better way. Also, the authority seems poised to move forward with funding for the Jordan Park renovation project. Cornell seemed astonished that they were able to do so without the monies denied by council due to lack of transparency. Not a hypocritical moment for him, unlike some others. Wheeler Bowman stated that they expected to pay a higher interest rate for the money, but have been able to secure funding without the city allowing them to use an issue of municipal bonds. Cornell was alarmed by this because he would rather not have people paying higher interest rates, but the legal team reminded him that the stonewall of action to deny the funding request was made with the understanding that if the board had met with the council at a committee of the whole the following week, the council would reconsider the request. That meeting didn't take place that following week, and the board didn't ask for funding again formally either, not even after the meeting that did take place in January. Then we had the first reading of three new ordinances. An ordinance increasing the fines for violating the city campaign finance regulations, and another allowing a portion of the alley to be vacated. We're giving second readings of April 18th. Also, the Kenwood Neighborhood Historic District application was given a public hearing for that date. It is expected to have much less opposition than the one for Driftwood. Council then heard from a city attorney resolving a complaint from Dorchester Holdings. The city had moved some contaminated soil from one spot to another with the consent of the property owner at that second place, and because of subsequent changes in ownership and further degradation of the contaminated soil, the city needs to move the soil again, this time to a landfill. The cost to the city is $1,120,500 to get it to a state-approved site in Manatee County. Council approved the proposal unanimously. For new business, Cornell proposes to get a charter amendment that would allow the city to receive grants for park conservation purposes. He stated that some monies were being left on the table and was unanimously referred to PS&I. Gerdes requested a discussion on possible amendments to the city's grease management program. He stated this in response to the three or more cases in which trapped grease has caused wastewater system failure. Current code allows grease traps to remain 20% full, but Pinellas County has required them to be completely emptied in the unincorporated areas it serves, and Gerdes would like to see the city follow suit. Council unanimously assigned it to PS&I as well. Rice wants to increase the fines for removing grand trees without a permit. I objected, noting the silence with which city officials allowed the state to destroy hundreds of trees for the Gandy Overpass project just a few years ago. Why ignore that big project and then stomp on the little guy? They ignored me and referred the proposal to the Housing, Land Use, and Transportation Committee. They also referred another infringement proposal by Rice to include gender identity and gender expression as a protected class. Rice also proposed adding a military increase to discussion for using a referendum to raise money for housing subsidies. Gabbard was irritated because the Housing, Land Use, and Transportation Committee already plans to take up the referendum issue. She also steadfastly opposes the military increase, being a realtor. I also spoke against the tax increase. I reminded the council that increasing the cost floor eliminates prices below that cost floor. They didn't listen and referred it to the committee, with only Gabbard voting no. Gabbard then requested to put the Fort Pinellas Study Gateway Master Plan on the HLUT calendar. The study will be complete in June. I have objections to the study itself, mostly because I strongly object to central planning, but also because PSTA has a history of wasteful spending. Couldn't recall my exact objections in that moment, though, so I withdrew. Then council gave the committee reports, including for the committee meetings that I could not attend on March 14th and 15th. The Budget, Finance, and Taxation Committee heard an insurance report. The costs of insurance increased for each category of water resources, general and highly protected risk properties, such as the police department headquarters in Sundown. The Public Services and Infrastructure Committee moved changes to the sign code to the April 18th City Council meeting for first reading. The Health, Energy, Resiliency, and Sustainability Committee took no action, but heard from activists. The co-sponsored events committee accepted the applications for a couple more events, including some watch parties for the Tampa Bay Lightning during the impending NHL playoffs. The Legislative Affairs and Intergovernmental Relations Committee met with a bunch of government officials, some of whom promised to steer more tax dollars the city's way. For the more recent committee meetings, as expected, the HLUT report included the approval of the nominations for Stephanie Owens and Jerry Lynn Evans to the St. Petersburg Housing Authority Board of Commissioners. The report from the Committee of the Whole on March 28th culminated with the approval of the $650,000 of Wikiwachi funds for the Maximo Park project, with Dr. Tomlin stating that all efforts to find funding elsewhere had come up empty. Next week's City Council meeting will be a mini-meeting with mostly awards and presentations, but no spending proposals. However, there are committee meetings planned for beforehand. Keep an eye on our Facebook page for live videos in the meantime. You can find it at facebook.com/STPTFLnews. You can also follow me on Twitter at @JoshBlackSt. Thanks for listening. This has been St. Petersburg, Florida Area News, a production of the Reconstructionist Radio Network.